Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a panel discussion sponsored by the Institute for Human Sciences titled, Georgia on My Mind, Can the European Union Cope? Speaking will be Jolaine Howorth, Jean Monnet Professor of European Politics at the University of Bath and Visiting Professor of Political Science and International Affairs at Yale University, and Jacques Ripnik, Director of Research at the Center of Studies and International Research Paris, CERI. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Professor Vivian Schmidt, Director of Boston University's Center for International Relations.
Today's event, Georgia on My Mind, Can the EU Cope? Now, you might think that the title, Georgia on My Mind, comes from the popular ballad. And indeed, it could, but only if we emphasize the line, oh, Georgia, no peace I find. Note that I'm not singing this, for good reason. But the Georgia we're referring to is clearly not the one for which this is the official state song. This is not the U.S. state of Georgia that we're talking about, but the state of Georgia. And recent events would suggest that another song with the same lines is more appropriate for the topic. Can you guess which one? Back in the USSR by the Beatles, which opens with the sounds of jet aircraft landing, tells of the singer's great happiness on returning home where the Ukraine girls really knock me out and the Moscow girls make me sing and shout, and where Georgia is on my mind. Some of you may remember this song. And yes, Georgia is on all of our minds right now, raising questions for some about whether we are indeed back to the USSR. Today, we focus on the events in the Republic of Georgia and the responses from the US and the EU, as well as from EU member states. The events in Georgia, in which a Georgian incursion into South Ossetia, protected by Russian peacekeepers, led to a Russian invasion into the subsequent declaration of independence by South Ossetia and Abkhazia, recognized by Russia and one other state, Nicaragua, raises a number of questions which our two panelists will address. And the kinds of questions they're going to address are things like, why is Georgia so important to the EU? Why is a strategic partnership of the EU with Russia important? What about NATO membership and the splits in the EU in particular in light of the U.S. pushing NATO membership? What about the missile shield as a source of dissension amongst EU member states and tension with the Russians? Think about the U.S. reaction if Russia were to put missiles in Cuba, claiming that it was trying to deter potential threat from Latin American terrorists. Or better, were the Russians to put missiles on that little island next to Alaska? Okay, but in addition to the transatlantic issues and EU foreign policy issues, we also have to look inward to the different ways in which the EU member states have responded to the events. We'll begin with Jolaine Howorth, who will speak about the foreign policy issues. I'm not going to give a lengthy introduction in terms of who our speakers are, but Jolaine Howorth is Jean Monnet Professor of European Politics at the University of Bath, and since 2002, he's essentially been a permanent visiting professor of political science at Yale University. I'll just mention one of his recent books, which is Security and Defense Policy in the European Union, which came out in 2007. He will speak first, and then we will have Jacques Ripnik, who will speak on internal dissensions and relations. And he is a director of research at Sciences Po, and his latest book is The Suburbs of Europe. And I think on that, we will stop the introductions, and I'll give it over to Jolaine.
Okay, thank you very much, Vivian. I will, yes, aim to say three things in 20 minutes, thereabouts. First, why is Georgia so important for the European Union? You may not have realized that it is, but there was a very excellent study done in February 2006 called Why Georgia Matters. And it matters for at least three major reasons for the European Union. First of all, because it's the first major test of the European Union's foreign policy. So far, the Union has succeeded in absorbing other countries through an enlargement policy, but basically an enlargement policy is dead easy. You simply say, if you want membership, you agree to this, 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 and this, and then sign on the bottom line. It takes years, but you do it. It's not a foreign policy. A foreign policy involves negotiations with people who may not share your preferences, and it involves the adoption of a rather subtle way of trying to persuade them to get their preferences in line with yours. Georgia is the first major challenge to the US, to the EU in that respect. Secondly, Georgia speaks to all of the main pillars of the European security strategy, that document that was signed and made public in December 2003. Very important document. Talks about three things: tackling external threats in the form of terrorism, organized crime, and failing states. Secondly, promoting a rules-based international order based on effective multilateralism. And thirdly, building a secure neighborhood, a ring of friends around the EU. On all those three measures, Georgia is absolutely crucial. But thirdly, of course, Georgia is now the border. Ever since Bulgaria and Romania became members of the EU in January 2007, the immediate border now, this border, is a crucial border, the border with Ukraine as well. But I would argue that those borders have now become the sort of test case of what the EU can do in the world. So it's been engaging with Georgia ever since Georgia became a sovereign state in 1992. There have been a whole range of official documents, plans, partnership agreements, etc., etc. The appointment of special representatives from the EU to Georgia. A mass of energy and activity has been put into Georgia, and we can ask the question, what does this all amount to? Unfortunately, before the summer of this year, it didn't really amount to an awful lot. Although the Commission, the European Commission, tried to persuade the European Union to adopt a real strategic approach to Georgia, the Council, the European Council, the members, the heads of state and government, who were, there's 27 of them, they tend to be divided on these issues, didn't really want to push this very far and didn't. And a very good example of that, for instance, despite all of the energy that had been put into Georgia, is that when the Russians vetoed the OSCE monitoring of the border mission, the border between Russia and Georgia, the Georgian government, Saakashvili government, practically begged the European Union to step in and take the place of the OSCE, but the European Union was too lacking in political will to do this. And for Georgia, this was a kind of a huge disappointment, which demonstrated that the European Union, despite all of this noise, was not really a strategic partner at this point. And so they began to put their hopes in the USA, and they began to believe that membership of NATO was a quicker and easier route into the West. And then came the 7th of August 2008. And I think the lessons of the 7th of August 2008 will be with us for a long time. I think this will be a cardinal date in the post-Cold War world, and I want to give you three reasons why that is the case. First of all, there's no question that after 20 years of effacement and, seen from Moscow's perspective, humiliation, Russia is back. Russia is back. It's asserted that it has red lines. It's asserted that it intends to exercise preponderance over its near abroad. It has said that it holds many of the high cards, and indeed it does hold many of the high cards in the Southern Caucasus. And for the EU, for the European Union, there is no alternative. There is simply no alternative than to engage with Russia in as constructive a way as possible. Secondly, now, the Russian occupation of and recognition of the independence of South Ossetia and Abkhazia, these two enclaves inside Georgia, has essentially pulled the rug on whatever the European Union thought it was doing in those enclaves. It had thrown money and projects at them in an attempt to get them out of the isolation into which they sort of more or less got themselves. But the Russian action has made that impossible. And although the EU used to pay lip service to something called the territorial integrity of Georgia, that is to say that those enclaves belong to Georgia, that is essentially a thing of the past, and the EU is going to have to come up with another end state another solution to the Georgian enclave problem. But third, given these two situations, Russia is back and the situation of South Ossetia and Abkhazia, the territorial integrity is a problem, Georgia's ultimate relationship with the EU becomes the highest stakes in this whole problem, in this whole issue. It's the key stake. The reality is that NATO membership for Georgia is now extremely unlikely, certainly in whatever the foreseeable future means. And that's equally true for Ukraine. But that means, by the same token, that the ultimate solution for Ukraine and Georgia is membership of the European Union. It's not going to happen overnight, but happen it must, and eventually, I suggest to you, happen it will. Can the EU pull this off? It takes me into my second part, which is to do with the EU's leadership role in this conflict. It's become something of a truism to say, aha, finally the EU has woken up and has taken leadership in a major international crisis. And to a very large extent it has. Part of it is due to the hyper-energetic president of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, who immediately jetted off to Moscow to sort things out on the 12th of August, only 4 days into the crisis. Whether he had a clue what he was doing or what he was going to say when he got to Moscow will remain a closely guarded secret, which the archives will not even reveal. But he did not wait for a green card or a green light from George W. Bush, who you may recall was still hanging around in Beijing watching the Olympic Games as the tanks rolled into Georgia, as indeed was Condoleezza Rice still on vacation until the 12th of August. Sarkozy pulls off a six-point plan, which is still the basis of the resolution of this problem. The 6 points, let's just remember, no resort to force, definitive end to hostilities, free access to humanitarian aid, Georgian military forces must return to their normal bases, Russian military forces must withdraw to the pre-7th of August positions, and there must be international talks on the eventual status of Abkhazia and South Ossetia. Now, whatever happened in all of that to the territorial integrity of Georgia? It doesn't appear in the six-point plan. Has the EU abandoned it because it was always there before? Well, France tried to slip this in to a resolution which it was preparing for the United Nations Security Council in later in August. And that resolution would make reference to the territorial integrity of Georgia. Russia simply said, if you put that resolution through, we'll veto it, so you're wasting your time. And they backed off. So the fact of the matter is that this key issue of the territorial integrity of Georgia has slipped off the agenda, and for most, I think, observers, that is simply a reality which we have to deal with. Condoleezza Rice, the day all this happened, expressed tremendously enthusiastic support for the EU's lead. And Sarkozy has been very proactive in pushing forward and achieving almost full implementation of this six-point plan. He's, you know, flown back and forth to Tbilisi and to Moscow several times. They've had extraordinary meetings of the EU foreign ministers, the GERC. They've had an extraordinary meeting of the European Council, which is the heads of state and government of all 27 member states. They've deployed now EU monitors, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. They've appointed a special representative from the EU to Georgia on its own. Most special representatives deal with regions in the world. This one is Georgia alone. They convened an international conference to discuss the future of the enclaves. That's point six of the six-point plan. Opened in Geneva, got off to a very bad start because, like many of these things, they can't agree on who sits around the table or what position you're in or who's in, who's out of which room at what time. Bad start. We'll be reconvened later. And then we have the donors conference, the international donors conference. All of this has been pushed through by the French presidency in double quick time. So not bad. Plus, there is this EU monitoring mission, which was put together very, very fast. It was only agreed on the 8th of September in Moscow. It was then proposed on the 15th of September at an EU Special Council meeting, and within a week we had double the number of volunteers to go into Georgia than were required. Only 200 have been agreed with the Russians. We actually have something like 350, a team of 350 EU officials in Georgia at the moment, monitoring these buffer zones and so on and so forth. We can go into what they're doing there. There is some concern, even though the Russians have pulled back from these so-called buffer zones, there is some concern that the Russian troops are still patrolling around areas of the enclaves which were previously under Georgian government control. And that remains kind of controversial. But nevertheless, the Russian foreign minister and the Russian president, Medvedev, have both said that they accept and recognize the European Union as the obvious partner for this enterprise, as an honest broker, and as a guarantor of the security of South Ossetia and Abkhazia. So the bottom line is that the EU actually has led in this particular crisis. The US, apart from a certain amount of rhetorical saber-rattling from the usual quarters, has taken a very decided back seat. And we can talk in questions about the American role in this, if you like. So the EU, in a sense, has to cope. It has been, you know, found itself lumbered with this problem, and it's going to have to deal with it. And the first thing it's going to have to do, and this is my third and final point, is it's going to have to work out a sensible relationship with Russia, which is not going to be easy. Reminds me of the French song, Je t'aime moi non plus. Je t'aime moi non plus. Okay? It's a complicated relationship with Russia. What the Russia-Georgia conflict has made crystal clear in Brussels is that this is the number one foreign policy and strategic priority for the EU at this point in time. Two documents are being prepared right now. One of them is a wholesale reappraisal of the EU's relationship with Russia, which will be put to, is being prepared by the Commission, will be put to the Russia summit that takes place on the 14th of November, the EU-Russia summit. At that same summit, another document, which the Commission is also putting together, focusing on a so-called Eastern Partnership between the EU and Moldova, Ukraine, and Georgia for economic development and democratization. Now, the relationship between the EU and Russia has always been very difficult. Jacques will say a lot more about this. But this crisis has concentrated the minds very considerably, and for the moment, I stress, for the moment, the EU has succeeded in sticking together around an agreed line. It's not the same thing to say they agree, but they've managed to stick together around an agreed line. Let me just say a couple of words about the relationship of strength here between the EU and Russia, because it's often assumed that the EU is just a political football as far as Russia is concerned. It's not so. Russia is in many ways in a very weak position, totally isolated internationally. I mean, Nicaragua, come on. The only state that supports Russia, despite phenomenal pressure on all its neighbors to recognize South Ossetia and Abkhazia. Nobody has done it. The taming of Georgia will not be easy. Russia thought it was going to kick Saakashvili out. Hasn't happened, and the EU prevented that to a large extent. It has a very structurally vulnerable and weak economy. Inflation is on the rise. The armed forces are generally regarded as fairly poor. Their performance in Georgia was certainly substandard. It has a restive and insecure middle class on which its future really hinges, has a disastrous health, demographic, and educational situation. It needs friends, and to that extent, it's looking for friends. On the other hand, the way the West has played its cards in Kosovo, and to some extent in Georgia and Ukraine, have put Russia in a very powerful position. Because objectively, if you ask yourself what is the difference between Kosovo's situation and the South Ossetia and Abkhazia situation, we can talk about it in questions, there isn't a lot. And the support, the popular support in Russia for Medvedev and Putin is phenomenal. The slogan replicates that old NATO thing that Lord Ismay came out, you know, that NATO was designed to keep the Americans in, the Russians out, and the Germans down. The slogan in Moscow these days is that they've succeeded in getting Russia up, America down, and Europe out. Okay? They feel strong. But the EU is actually in quite a strong position. It has much, 450 million people as opposed to 140. It's 10 times richer than Russia. It has the largest and biggest attractive market, which the Russian companies want to get a piece of the cake. Moscow, whatever it says, wants to join the WTO, and there's leverage there. Russia desperately needs EU finance, know-how, and investment right across the board. They want access to EU programs in research, education, and science. And above all, they want to travel to the EU. This has become, you know, almost a fetish for Russians, you know, Côte d'Azur, the ski slopes, etc., etc. And the amount of money that is transferred back into Russia by Russian prostitutes operating in the ski resorts, I can tell you, is pretty considerable. The EU can get a lot of leverage on control of those visas and travel. There are six major policy areas. I'm going to finish on this. Where the EU and Russia, if you look at it very objectively, can probably find a meeting of minds. It won't be easy, but it's possible. One of them is really the stabilization of that huge border, 3,500-kilometer border from the Barents Sea down to the Black Sea, where there's very little other than tensions and destabilization. That is not in the interests either of the EU or Russia to continue. Secondly, the whole issue of the rule of law. Medvedev came in as president promising to establish the rule of law in Russia without a firm legal footing, both for the other things that the EU is going to negotiate, but also for that long border area. None of it is going to be possible. Energy security, again, people say, well, the EU is dependent on energy, but Russia is also dependent on EU markets. And one can negotiate diversification in both directions. Fourth thing, economic and trade relations are extremely strong. Russia is very much in need of EU inputs. I mean, if Russia is strong today, it's because it's wealthy, and it's wealthy because of the European Union. There is a leverage there. On Iran, both the EU and Russia have a very, very strong interest in preventing the weaponization of the Iranian nuclear program. And to date, the Russians have been playing relatively in line with the Europeans on that. Counterterrorism is another area where interests can easily converge, even though the EU and Russia may have differences about the way you go about implementing counterterrorism. So there's a whole range of major issues on which there is potential for the EU to develop or find a strategic partnership. But the negotiating stance is very vital. The EU has got to stay united. It knows it's got to stay united. That's very difficult. Again, Jacques will say much more about that. It's no point threatening or immediately talking about sanctions or whatever, because snubbing Russia and taking that sort of attitude simply fires nationalism within the country. The alternative to the Medvedev-Putin team would be something very much worse. They can seek out shared interests, and they must seek out shared interests, and the EU must aim to ease Russia's return to a framework of international law. The EU must be firm on essential values. Russia cannot dictate what political course a given nation state can be allowed to take. But at the same time, the EU needs to be sensitive to Russia's genuine paranoia and deeply felt security concerns about what has happened over the last 20 years. As a BBC commentator said, and I quote, "It is ridiculous, indeed it is Orwellian, to be telling Russians that further NATO expansion is in no way threatening, it is not aimed at Russia, and that even it will be good for Russia." This is the sort of line that we've been trying to make them swallow, and they ain't swallowing it. And something should be whispered behind closed doors rather than shriek from the rooftops. Diplomacy is not a megaphone instrument. Push for a regional security pact. This has got to be made into a regional issue. and we are some way towards resolving this question. The title of the talk is Can the EU Cope? The EU has no alternative but to cope. And on this one, it's likely to be very much on its own, with American discreet backing. This is probably the greatest foreign policy test the EU has yet had to deal with, and we'll see how it does it. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be in the Boston branch of the Institute for Human Sciences. I know well the Viennese headquarters. And, the subject we're talking about is seen here from a European angle, but I suppose in the discussion you will also bring perhaps comparison with the American concerns. Not that we should compare Georgia with your Georgia here. That's not what I had in mind. But the American responses to Russia or to European attempts at mediating diplomacy. I'm struck by two things in this European response to the Georgian crisis. First, how it has revived within the EU certain dividing lines that we had seen 5 years ago over the relationship to the United States and the war in Iraq. We now have not the United States as the dividing issue, but the relationship to Russia as a dividing issue within the EU. That is interesting thing. And to some extent, it is the same countries that are involved in this divide. And the second thing is that despite very significant divisions on the perceptions, on the responses to the Georgian crisis, the European Union, under the French presidency, I think Julian was right to stress its role, has managed to be a united actor and a voice in this crisis. It seems paradoxical. The EU has no divisions, a bit like the Pope, you know, the Stalin's statement about the Pope, how many divisions? But Europe has no divisions to send to Georgia or elsewhere, but it has provided effective mediation, very prompt, and Jolyon suggested improvise, and I think probably it was highly improvised until the last very moment, but on the whole, quite effective. And I will not go into the mediating role, we can return to that, but I'm more interested in this paradox of a deeply divided group that produces quite a united consensus to act, to respond to a crisis. Few of these divisions, they concern, first of all, the reading of the crisis itself. For most West European countries, the reading of the Georgian crisis was a really reckless Georgian president, possibly inspired by American advisors, has started a conflict with high risk of confronting a much more powerful Russian army. And, he's been punished for that. And now we have to pick up the pieces. That was sort of most of the West European. The East European response was, you know, the tanks of August. For the Czechs, 40 years after, you see Russian tanks crossing the border of a sovereign state, and you have certain memories, even for those who didn't live through, that return. You read the same event very differently. And curious and sometimes dubious analogies are being used, you know. Immediately the word Munich is being launched, not just in the Czech press, in the Polish response as well. Munich is, of course, you can see the analogy. A democratic country which has a national minority on its territory is being assaulted by a neighboring great power, which is using the minority issue for expansion. That is the analogy. It's a very dubious analogy. I mean, I don't know how many PhDs have been or should be written about the use and abuse of the Munich analogy, but this is a problematic analogy. Indeed, if one were to follow it, the equivalent would be if President Benesch in 1938 had started bombarding the Sudetenland. That would be sort of the analogy. He, in fact, was doing exactly the opposite. He was bending over backwards, trying to make all concessions possible to the Germans living in Czechoslovakia, but clearly neither the German Sudeten German party in Czechoslovakia nor, of course, Adolf Hitler were interested in that. So that's a problem with the analogies we're using, and I know that in the American press as well this has been sometimes the case. But clearly there is a difference of responses to a different reading of the event in Western Europe and among the new members from Eastern Europe. In fact, the new members have created a group which they call the Friends of Georgia, and which includes the Baltic countries, the Central European, the Visegrad countries, except for Hungary, interestingly. But Hungary replaced by Romania, a newcomer that way to Central Europe, if you want. They are trying within the European Union, of course, to have a common stance on this particular issue. The second difference is not just reading of the crisis, but what should be the European policy towards this region. And the main tool the European Union has at its disposal is a so-called European neighborhood policy. So this is a policy that has been devised at about the same time when the eastward enlargement took place in 2004. And for the West Europeans, the neighborhood policy is clearly meant to promote a relationship with countries further east or further south, actually, to the European Union, without offering the membership of the European Union. That is the main aim. You try to stabilize the periphery, but without the prospect of inclusion. For the new member states, for the Central and East Europeans, the neighborhood policy should be a pre-accession policy, should not preclude accession. It should be preparing those countries for future accession. So it's a very significant difference. And indeed, we now have debates about what the European Union should be offering Ukraine in December. There might be a decision about what kind of relationship with Ukraine. The main dividing line there is between the older and the new members. Basically, the new members demand that associate membership of the European Union is being proposed to Ukraine, because they see the Georgian crisis as connected as a first hint of a possible Russian policy vis-à-vis Moldova or Ukraine. And Ukraine, obviously, this is even more serious business because it's a country of the size of France with 50 million inhabitants, which has a large Russian population there, has a naval base in Sevastopol, and has, of course, in the Crimea, a territory that became Ukrainian only in 1954 as a gift of Nikita Khrushchev to the Ukrainian Republic. But it didn't mean much in the Soviet days. It means a lot. It means a lot today. So a different approach to what the neighborhood policy should be, and you find a very similar divide over NATO expansion. There was a summit of NATO at the beginning of April in Bucharest. And there again, the question of do you offer Ukraine or Georgia a membership action plan, so-called MAP, which is a first step towards joining NATO. And you had a clear divide. All the founding members of the European Union opposed it, and all the new members approved it. And now, of course, given what happened during the summer in August in Georgia, the East Europeans say, if we had offered a membership action plan for NATO to Georgia, perhaps the Russians would not have moved in. The West Europeans said, thank God we didn't offer any promise of that sort to Russia, because that would have been not only Georgia would have lost Ossetia and Abkhazia anyway, but we also would have lost NATO. There would be no NATO left, because nobody would have, of course, started a war with Russia because of Georgia. If you want simply an indication of why this is so, you can see I brought with me an opinion poll which was published in the Financial Times. It's in September. It's actually quite interesting, because it shows West European, well, all European perplexity, not just about military spending, but about confronting Russia. So the one thing that you see as a change is increased perception of Russia as a threat. Before August, only 4% of Europeans consider Russia as a threatening country. After the Georgia crisis, it's 17%. But that's quite expected. If you see tanks on your TV set, you usually think this is bad news. But the interesting point is that most Europeans would not support their country getting militarily involved in a place, not just in a place like Georgia, but they would oppose national armies defending East European nations from Russian attack. For Germany, Italy, and Spain, a majority of people would even oppose, over 50% of the people would oppose intervention on behalf of the Baltic countries. Only a quarter would support that. So this is for Baltic countries who are already members of NATO. So that makes you wonder about the value of Article 5 guarantee, you know, if you have this kind of perception of the public opinion. Only in France and Britain, these are the two countries where you would still have majority in favor of intervention in such case. This is, of course, I'm mentioning this to explain it's not just that the politicians are cautious, it's just the public opinion also wouldn't want to start a war for a faraway country of which we know little, to use again a phrase that was used at the time of Munich. I criticize the Munich analogy, and then I'm using it myself, as you can see. So this is really the second division on what kind of neighborhood policy, is it pre-accession or not, and should we mean NATO expansion to Georgia or to Ukraine, or really has Georgian recklessness this summer killed the prospect of any future enlargement in this region, and that is my impression, at least from for the moment. The third dividing point, probably the most important, which of course connects with the two previous one, is the attitude, the perception, and the policies towards Russia. And here the division between old and new members is most striking. It's quite predictable, you will tell me, that given their historical experience, they've been for 40 years in the Soviet Empire, so their experiences of Russia are very different, radically different from that of the West Europeans. They had, of course, from the beginning, a very skeptical reading about the possibility of Russia to evolve into a democracy. I remember in the 1990s discussion in Prague with Polish colleagues, etc. Very few people thought Russia would. They thought this was really a Western delusion. And now, you know, there's this sort of "we told you so" attitude. They were skeptical about Russia from the beginning, and if you're skeptical long enough, eventually you may be proved right. So this is the feeling now that resurgent Russia, well, it's less of a surprise for the new members than for the old members. One could argue, of course, that what has happened this summer in Georgia brings the perceptions of East and West European closer. That is, even those who didn't get it before this summer are getting it now. That is, the idea that Russia is not just internally regressing as a democratic or democratizing country, but it is becoming increasingly assertive on its neighborhood. So the perceptions may be more convergent, but that doesn't help you to address the question of what policies you should follow. Because, again, the East Europeans, the new members of the EU, advocated at a summit in Avignon, some of them advocated sanctions, possible sanctions against Russia. It's not quite clear what they would entail, what kind of trade. And in any case, suspend all negotiations about a partnership treaty between the European Union and Russia. That would be the clear response. Whereas the most West Europeans would oppose any talk of sanctions. It's not considered as effective. And the idea is that talks about the partnership with Russia should resume immediately as soon as Russia fulfills the condition about retreating from Georgia proper into the two enclaves. So you have there three themes which divide inside the European Union, and that, of course, then translates into different reactions, different postures. I mean, obviously, Poland has been most visible about this because perhaps rhetorically it was the strongest in its response, and also because immediately after the invasion of Georgia, it has signed the deal with the United States about the military, the missile shield base in Poland, and the American contribution to the modernization of the Polish military, including Patriot missiles. And I'm not, I mean, Jolyon is a military expert, and he would know whether the missile shield will be effective, the Polish missile shield will be effective against missiles from Korea or from Iran or wherever. But Patriot missiles can hit neither Korea nor Iran. So the message, I think, was clear. The Russians got it, and everybody else got it, of course. That is now the problem. That is the country that is the most important among the new members, that is Poland. On one hand, deals response to the Georgian crisis with a bilateral deal with the United States on the missile base and Patriot missiles, but at the same time advocates collective European response to oppose Russian action. And there obviously is not necessarily great coherence in trying to do it that way. So I think I'm running out of time. I will simply conclude by saying that the Georgian crisis is really a test for the European Union. It has successfully enlarged to Eastern and Central Europe. It has so far failed to adopt a new constitution. Now it is facing a major foreign and security policy challenge. And it can be a defining moment for the European Union. In other words, it has been good on its immediate periphery. Can it today propose a larger geopolitical strategic vision? Because, of course, if we're talking about Georgia and the Caucasus, it's not just for the sake of this tiny country. It is because of the strategic importance of it. This is where the gas and oil from the Caspian Sea come to the West, through the Georgian territory, on the Black Sea to Turkey, to the Nabucco project, and from Turkey to the West. And South Ossetia is on this east-west corridor that divides Georgia. So obviously what is behind for the EU is relationship to Russia, geopolitical vision, and of course, do we have or not a coherent, unified energy strategy for the European Union? These are the main challenges that we face behind the Georgian crisis itself.
of you. So I think what we'll do now is open it up to the public.
Yes.
You refer to the recklessness of the behavior of Georgia in August. If you had been president, could you tell us what you would have done, please?
Well, I was talking about perceptions, of course. I didn't say this was my perception. It was widely shared perception that Saakashvili's policy has been, and to a large extent, yes, I think it was reckless. Because what would I have done? Well, you know, before you start a military action against a territory which until now has been largely under the influence of Russia, and where Russian soldiers are stationed, and a number of them have been killed, you have to think twice. And there is only two possibilities. Either you do it because you think you have, so to speak, a window of opportunity, that you have a political goal, which is to reclaim the territory, and you have a window of opportunity, which is what? It's the summer and the Olympics. You can consider this window. I don't know if for strategists this is enough of a window of opportunity. You have still the Bush administration and strong support from Mr. Cheney, and you think, okay, they will be out perhaps in November. This is the last chance. I don't know. You have to consider whether this is your goal and that you will achieve it by military means against Russia. And either you do it because you think you have backing from somebody else. If you do not have backing, then I really think it's reckless, yes. And then it's not only the perception widely shared in Western Europe, then it really is reckless. You are launching a gamble which has a small chance to succeed. Yes, I would call that reckless.
Thank you very much for your presentation and answers. I used to be advisor to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization headquarters in Moscow. So I have two questions. Is there any evidence that the pressure was really phenomenal? Because I think that Russia was ready psychologically to admit that nobody would support recognition of Ossetia and Abkhazia. How to evaluate and to assess who started war, whom to blame, whom we should blame. That's one point. And Russia, of course, tried to convince China and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization members, state, and later Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, to make a statement, but not more than this. This is the first question. And second question is, do European politicians really believe in Russian imperialism?
They may not use the same terms, the same language, but they all observe a similar pattern in recent years. And that is a big change from the 1990s. And that is a Russia that is increasingly restricting political pluralism inside, and that is increasingly assertive in its behavior outside. Now, they may have different readings of what this means. This is where this is perhaps where perceptions matter. For some, this is a setback, but let's say it is not regression to the Soviet Union. Russia is still a country where people can travel in and out, that there is even limited freedom of expression. So people would say this is Russia reacting to the 1990s, where it was basically simply considered taken for granted, and it is now being reasserting itself, and maybe it had reasons to do so, and they would quote NATO expansion to Russia's borders, the missile shield, the Kosovo question, etc. There's a long list of sort of Russian recriminations. And the argument is, well, you should take those recriminations seriously if you want to engage Russia, because otherwise our next conferences will be who lost Russia. You know, we will discuss, we will have endless conferences who lost Russia. That is one line of thinking. In other words, the pattern is there. Everybody sees what the Putin years have done. And then you can have different readings. And for the East Europeans, this is, you know, reassertion of Russian imperial ambitions. They always were like that. Because Russians never understood. Russia, historically, has never been a nation state. Russia has always been an empire.
Let me just answer the question about the pressure that was put on the Shanghai Cooperation Council. My understanding was that there was considerable pressure for two reasons. First of all, I mean, you say that you think that Russia didn't really expect anybody to recognize South Ossetia and Abkhazia. That strikes me as very difficult to believe. I think that, you know, in the long run, this will prove to have been a very serious misjudgment on the part of the Russians. The fact that only Nicaragua has gone along with this was Hezbollah, Hamas. There are rumors that some parts of Hezbollah, some parts of Hamas are thinking about it, but, you know, this is an uncomfortable position for a rising power to have done something and the rest of the world says, you know. And it sets tremendously dangerous precedents for the Russians themselves. I mean, there are all sorts of other secessionist enclaves out there which could cause nightmares. So I would be very surprised if Russia really thought that nobody would support recognition. I think they are very surprised that they haven't managed to get this this support.
Please join me in thanking our panelists.
You've been listening to a panel discussion sponsored by the Institute for Human Sciences and titled Georgia on My Mind, Can the European Union Cope? Our speakers were Jolaine Howorth, Jean-Monnet Professor of European Politics at the University of Bath and Visiting Professor of Political Science and International Affairs at Yale University, and Jacques Ripnik, Director of Research at the Center of Studies in International Research Paris, CERI. Tonight's moderator was Professor Vivian Schmidt, director of Boston University's Center for International Relations. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Jim Keasley. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.